From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, the US and Russian presidents come face-to-face for the first time since the Ukraine crisis began, as leaders gather in France for D-Day commemorations.
These men waged war so that we might know peace. They sacrificed so that we might be free. They fought in hopes of a day when we'd no longer need to fight. We are grateful to them.
Also today, the president of Pakistan's most popular news broadcaster tells us why his channel has been forced off-air. And a year after Snowden's NSA leaks were published, we hear from the trailblazers of US whistleblowing.
It's because people are now discovering for the first time what happened to me and others. And that we were talking about this years before Snowden was ever known.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. World leaders are being joined by hundreds of veterans in northern France to mark the 70th anniversary of the D-Day landings. Heads of state attended commemorations at Oustram, one of five beaches landed on by Allied troops in 1944. Britain's Queen Elizabeth II traveled to France for the event, as did U.S. President Barack Obama and Russian President Vladimir Putin. 70 years ago, the BBC announced what would become World War II's major breakthrough.
Under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France.
On the sidelines of the memorial events, Russian President Vladimir Putin met with Ukraine's new leader, Petro Poroshenko, for the first time since his election. The two also met with German Chancellor Angela Merkel in Paris in an effort to urge a peaceful solution to violence in East Ukraine and tensions with Moscow. Europe correspondent Sandra Gatman reports.
It was a rare window of opportunity for diplomacy. With world leaders in France commemorating 70 years since the D-Day landings of World War II, Russian President Putin and Ukraine's new president, Petro Poroshenko, crossed paths for the first time since Russia annexed the Crimea region in southern Ukraine, prompting a tit-for-tat of targeted sanctions between Moscow and the United States, as well as the European Union. The two were joined by German Chancellor Angela Merkel, but no photographs taken at the scene so far have emerged showing the two shook hands. This week in Brussels, world leaders at G7 talks urged Russia to acknowledge Ukraine's new leadership and stop the flow of arms to separatists, or Moscow would face tougher economic sanctions.
The U.S. State Department has condemned the assassination attempt on Afghanistani presidential candidate Abdullah Abdullah. The suicide bomb attack left 6 people dead and 22 injured, although Mr. Abdullah escaped unharmed. A second round of voting is scheduled for June 14th. State Department spokesperson Marie Harf said the Afghans are responsible for providing security for their elections. She also said the U.S. still believes it is safe for voting to proceed next week.
We know Afghanistan is still a dangerous place. We've been clear about that. We saw in the first round, and certainly expect in the second round, the Afghan security forces step up and provide security for their own elections.
U.S. employers added over 200,000 jobs in May for the fourth straight month of solid gains. The numbers are a positive sign for a continued recovery after the winter slowdown. Ira Spitzer reports from New York.
With the latest jobs report, the U.S. economy has now regained the more than 8 million jobs lost during the economic downturn that began in 2007. The unemployment rate held steady at 6.3%, near its 6-year low. Business services, healthcare, and bars and restaurants were the leading drivers of job creation. Wages were up just slightly for the month, however, and have only increased 2% in the past year. That trend could potentially slow down future growth in consumer spending. All the major U.S. stock indexes turned positive after the report.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The suspect in the shooting deaths of 3 Canadian police officers is now under arrest. The city of Moncton, New Brunswick, had been under lockdown while a massive manhunt took place for 24-year-old Justin Burke. Officials report he was apprehended near midnight local time without incident. Burke is accused of killing 3 and injuring 2 members of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. Commanding Officer Roger Brown says the RCPM is mourning for their comrades.
The RCMP family is hurting. Greater Moncton is hurting, as is New Brunswick, as is our country.
The U.S. State Department says it is aware that a third American has been detained in North Korea. The official Korean Central News Agency says Jeffrey Edward Pfau has been detained and is being investigated for violating North Korean laws. Our Washington correspondent Priscilla Huff reports.
The U.S. State Department says their top priority is the safety of Americans abroad, but they've also warned Americans to not travel to North Korea. According to that country's official news agency, Jeffrey Edward Pfau has perpetrated activities that violated their laws and taken actions which do not fit his claim of being a tourist. He's the third American detained by Pyongyang. Kenneth Bay is serving 15 years hard labor for supposedly trying to proselytize Christianity. In April, Matthew Todd Miller allegedly tore up his visa at the airport and demanded asylum. The regime of Kim Jong-un has twice canceled meetings with American envoys to discuss the detention.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. World leaders and veterans have come together in northern France to mark the Allied landings, which began the invasion of Nazi-occupied Europe during World War II. The US president and his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, were among those in attendance. The commemorations also saw unscheduled meetings between leaders amid high tension over Ukraine. UK correspondent Ollie Barrett reports.
In Bayeux Cathedral, a service led by Right Reverend Nigel McCulloch, chaplain of the Royal British Legion.
Those of you who invaded these shores will, like each of us, one day pass to another shore, to a country far beyond, where above noise and danger there is lasting peace. And when that day comes, your story will live on here. For greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends.
Hundreds of D-Day veterans in northern France, where they landed 70 years ago in a military operation seen as the turning point in World War II. A series of events at beaches which these days are tourist hotspots. In 1944, they were five landing points for Allied forces. Military hardware on display to commemorate the day, President Obama told an audience at Colville-sur-Mer, changed more than just the course of the war.
And our victory in that war decided not just a century, but shaped the security and well-being of all posterity. We worked to turn old adversaries into new allies. We built new prosperity. We stood once more with the people of this continent through a long twilight struggle until finally a wall tumbled down and an iron curtain too. And from Western Europe to East, from South America to Southeast Asia, 70 years of democratic movements spread. And nations that once knew only the blinders of fear began to taste the blessings of freedom. None of that would have happened without the men who were willing to lay down their lives for people they'd never met.
And he led more than one standing ovation to some of the veterans assembled 70 years on from their historic mission.
These men waged war so that we might know peace. They sacrificed so that we might be free. They fought in hopes of a day when we'd no longer need to fight. We are grateful to them.
That mission was announced to the world 7 decades ago by the BBC.
This is London. Under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France.
The events also saw US President Barack Obama and Russian President Vladimir Putin speak on the margins of a leader's lunch, their first face-to-face since the Ukraine crisis started. Vladimir Putin also met Ukraine's president-elect Petro Poroshenko for the first time. French President François Hollande telling one D-Day veteran, "We made Russia and Ukraine talk," and speaking of the ceremony therefore being useful. 70 years to the day since Allied forces launched an operation which led to the defeat of Nazi Germany. Ollie Barrett reporting.
This is FSN Reports. Pakistan's most watched news broadcaster has been forced off air following a row with the country's intelligence agency. The country's media regulator has suspended GOTV's output for 2 weeks after the news channel aired allegations linking the ISI spy agency with the attempted assassination of a journalist. Imran Aslam is the president of GO Television, and he spoke to us earlier from Pakistan.
It all began on April the 19th. When one of our leading journalists and anchors, Hamid Mir, was attacked in Karachi. He was rushed to hospital with 6 bullets. And at that time, his family, who were in possession of some emails and correspondence from Hamid Mir, alleged on our channel that they believed that if something happened to Hamid Mir, the responsibility would lie with the ISI, which is the intelligence agency. This was their allegation, and we aired that news along with the picture of the DG of the ISI, and also at the same time took, you know, just like normal journalistic ethics would demand, we also put up a picture of the inter-services public relations chief and his rebuttal to the allegations. This is where the problem started, and they believed that we had sort of crossed some red line. A couple of days later, they complained via the Ministry of Defense to the regulatory authority, asking for a suspension or revocation of the license, and claimed that we had brought the ISI into disrepute, but also that we had been following an anti-Pakistan agenda for a long time. This was a sort of allegation that basically branded all of us and our entire staff as traitors. It was something that was very, very difficult for us to swallow. And so we've been attempting for the last 50 days to try and get some sort of justice, to try and get a redressal of this allegation somehow, because it has really placed all of our staff under serious threat.
So what will you be saying to your staff once this 15-day period has ended? Because the authorities, they will target you again if you don't toe the line.
Well, I mean, this has been a problem, because not only for us, but also because being the largest media group in the country, if this group is tamed and its voice is silent, or if we have to resort to some sort of self-censorship, I think all the space that we've gained over years of struggle to try and find our own voice and to give a voice to the people of this country, that might be very severely damaged. So our hope is that, you know, we can try and talk to the people concerned, to engage with them, and to try and work out some sort of a via media where the essence of the freedom of expression is not lost at all. Mm. And that we should continue, I think, in asking the questions that may be uncomfortable to certain people, and that we hope that the allegations against the ISI raised by the family of Hamid Mir would be proved to be incorrect. For me personally, I think it is important that the investigations continue unhindered, and that the people who committed that atrocious crime should be brought to justice. And I think that should lay all suspicions to the side. But because of all this hullabaloo that has been created since that horrible day, we find that the investigation has not really proceeded in the manner that it should have. And that raises all sorts of, you know, questions in the minds of people.
Imran Aslam, president of Pakistan's GO Television. Now, the exchange of US soldier Bo Bergdahl for 5 detainees has raised questions about the future of the facility at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The Obama administration continues to defend its decision to bring Sergeant Bergdahl out of Taliban custody in return for 5 Taliban fighters. Our Washington correspondent Priscilla Huff reports.
U.S. President Barack Obama has repeatedly defended his order to exchange U.S. Army Sergeant Bo Bergdahl for 5 prisoners at the Guantanamo Bay, Cuba detention center.
You have a couple of parents whose kid volunteered to fight in a distant land. who they hadn't seen in 5 years and weren't sure whether they'd ever see again.
Bo Bergdahl has been called a traitor and a deserter by his fellow soldiers. The U.S. military confirms he did walk off his base in Afghanistan at least once before he was captured, but further investigation is on hold pending his recovery from 5 years in captivity. Former Private First Class Kenneth Wortham served in the same platoon. He told Baltimore television station WJZ he rejects claims that Bo Bergdahl is a hero and a prisoner of war.
He's a liar and he's a phony. He's not an official American to me.
In an interview with CNN at the D-Day commemorations in Normandy, France, U.S. National Security Advisor Susan Rice repeated American policy that no one is left behind on the battlefield.
Regardless of the conditions of their capture, and as a prisoner of war, Bo Bergdahl deserved, and we had the obligation, and the commander-in-chief had the obligation, to do what was necessary to bring him home.
American lawmakers are angry, in part because the U.S. Congress was not formally notified of the plans to exchange Bo Bergdahl for five Taliban held at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. U.S. Senator Marco Rubio, after a closed-door briefing.
In my opinion, there's no question that the president violated the law by not notifying Congress. But to me, the most pressing challenge that we face is the fact that the president has now released five of the most dangerous individuals in Guantanamo, if not the five most dangerous.
149 prisoners remain at the detention center. 78 are cleared for release. But despite President Obama's promises to shutter the facility, the five exchanged for Bo Bergdahl are the only ones who have left recently. Margaret Huang is with Amnesty International.
It is an immoral center. You can't hold people without bringing charges. It's a fundamental principle of our Constitution and of international human rights law.
As for the five Taliban now transferred to Qatar, travel restrictions have been imposed on them in part to ensure they do not immediately return to fighting with the Taliban in Afghanistan. But campaigners point out those five were probably actually guilty, whereas 78 remain at Guantanamo Bay, cleared of any offenses, and yet with little prospect of leaving the detention center anytime soon. Priscilla Huff, Washington.
Now, we've been marking the moment 1 year ago when the world began to learn the extent of the massive secret electronic surveillance program centered at the US National Security Agency. Internal documents were leaked by Edward Snowden, but before him there were others who had tried to raise the alarm years earlier. Our Washington correspondent Daniel Renches has been speaking to them.
Yes, Edward Snowden will go down in history for opening the doors of the electronic surveillance state. But if we had listened to former NSA crypto-mathematician William Binney, then it would not have come as a surprise. More than a decade ago, he was the key architect of a software system, Thin Thread, designed to sift computer and phone metadata.
Try to design a program that could be able to look into terabytes of data passing by in the digital age and look into it and see what was important to pull out and sort that for the analysts to analyze.
As the NSA's technical leader for intelligence, Binney objected when, he says, privacy protections in the software were taken out shortly after the 2001 terrorist attacks. Believing they'd violated the US Constitution, he and colleague Kirk Wiebe resigned.
It's probably the most critical attack on the Constitution of the United States in the history of our nation.
And then attempted to convince the US Congress, the Justice Department, and even Chief Justice of the Supreme Court John Roberts to take action. With no success, they turned to journalists who wrote exposés, prompting government efforts to prosecute them on spying charges. Public opinion, however, was left largely unchanged.
They didn't take us seriously because it was just us saying it. It was our words in front of a camera or with a newspaper reporter. No documents, no evidence, and there's a normal human desire to believe that those who are running your country, those who are in charge of defense, for example, how could they do something so wrong? Wouldn't they do the right thing? And we all believe that. And we all believe that. I believed it. How could they do this? But I didn't have documents to prove it.
William Binney says Edward Snowden decided to steal documents and flee the country because of their lack of success and the obstacles they faced.
Because he took the documentation that they were using to brief the programs they were running inside their organizations. So it's impossible for them to deny that they're doing it.
Former NSA senior executive Thomas Drake is another member of this group.
Because people are now, in some cases, rediscovering or discovering for the first time what happened to me and others. And that we were talking about this years before Snowden was ever known.
Drake also fought off criminal prosecution after raising concerns internally, resigning, and turning to the media.
The difference in terms of surveillance and the extraordinary disclosures of Edward Snowden is that we're finally having a debate that we had never had before. So I'm encouraged by we're at least having the conversation.
Daniel Renches, Washington.
And finally tonight, FSN Spotlight, the segment of the show when we bring you a story you might have missed. With today's edition, Simon Marks.
On FSN Spotlight today, the US policy towards Syria and the former highly placed Obama administration official who says he can no longer defend it. In a week that saw Syrian President Bashar al-Assad celebrating his victory in the country's election with a claimed 88.7% of the vote, in Washington, eyebrows were raised by Robert Ford until February 2012, the Obama administration's man in Damascus. As ambassador working first in the Syrian capital, then after his withdrawal at the State Department, he says he worked tirelessly to persuade the White House to do more to support the Syrian opposition. He left the State Department earlier this year in frustration, and on Tuesday gave his version of events to Margaret Warner of the PBS NewsHour. She started by asking him about his reaction to the Syrian election.
I don't think it'll have much impact on the battlefield. I have no indications that the opposition and the armed opposition groups are going to stop fighting. So I think the election will have no result on that. It really is simply a signal. The election is a signal to us, to other countries in the region, to Europe, etc., that Assad is not leaving. He is staying deeply entrenched in the capital in Syria, even as other parts of the country remain outside his control.
And so is it time for us to recognize that, in fact, he's going to be there a long time, that the whole strategy, both of the opposition and the Western and Gulf and neighbor-backed efforts, hasn't worked?
Well, certainly the efforts that we have made to date have not worked. They've not put enough pressure on the regime on the ground, and that's why the peace talks that we tried to do in January and February in Geneva, and I was there, and the regime completely refused to discuss a political settlement. Policy has not brought them to the point where they feel they have to negotiate. They're not under enough pressure. So we need to think about how to escalate pressure.
You left as ambassador in early 2012.
In February, right.
Under fears for your own safety and the safety of the
safety
entire embassy.
Team, yeah.
But you stayed on at the State Department. Why have you left now?
In the end, Margaret, I worked from Washington on the Syria issue for 2 years. Events on the ground were moving, and our policy was not evolving very quickly. We were constantly behind the curve, and that's why now we have extremist threats to our own country. We had a young man from Florida, apparently, who was involved in a suicide bombing. And there will be more problems like that, I fear. Our policy was not evolving, and I finally got to the point where I could no longer defend it publicly. And it's as a professional career member of the U.S. Diplomatic Service, when I can no longer defend the policy in public, it is time for me to go.
What was the biggest mistake you think the Obama administration, this government, made?
We've consistently been behind the curve, that events on the ground are moving more rapidly than our policy has been adapting. And at the same time, Russia and Iran have been driving this by increasing and steadily increasing massively, especially the Iranians, their support to the Syrian regime. And the result of that has been more threats to us in this ungoverned space, which Assad can't retake. We need, and we have long needed, to help moderates in the Syrian opposition with both weapons and other non-lethal assistance. Had we done that a couple of years ago, had we ramped it up, frankly, the al-Qaeda groups that have been winning adherence would have been unable to compete with the moderates who, frankly, we have much in common with. But the moderates have been fighting constantly with arms tied behind their backs because they don't have the same resources that either Assad does or the al-Qaeda groups in Syria do.
But you know the arguments we all heard from many in the White House, which is if we arm the opposition, we don't know who will get a hold of these advanced
weapons. I've
heard
those arguments, Margaret. To be very frank, we have plenty of information on reliable groups, and we have long had that. It is a question of whether or not there's will to actually help people whose agenda is compatible with our national security interests, and then to make a decision and push forward. I'm simply going to say that I think it's on record now that the State Department for a long time has advocated doing much more to help the moderates in the Syrian opposition. These moderates, by the way, who evolved directly from the peaceful protest movement that I saw with my own eyes in 2011. And those people need more help. And arguments that we're worried about things are going to trickle into bad hands or that it's going to, you know, bring in American troops directly, nobody's asking for American troops to be sent to Syria. I was in Iraq for 5 years. The last thing we want is to have a repeat of the Iraq experience. But there are other tools in our toolkit, and those are the things we need to work on in conjunction with our allies in the region.
Robert Ford, the former U.S. ambassador to Syria, speaking there to the PBS NewsHour's Margaret Warner. And you can see more of that interview online at pbs.org. The ambassador's comments caused deep embarrassment at the State Department where he used to work. On Tuesday, State Department spokeswoman Marie Harf took to the podium in the briefing room and faced reporters' questions.
I saw those comments. As you know, Ambassador Ford served a very long, distinguished career here, is now a private citizen, obviously entitled to his own views. I think, broadly speaking, on some of what you addressed, and then if I miss anything, let me know. Look, the president was clear in his speech last week. We've all been clear that we're frustrated by the situation in Syria. You heard the president at West Point say we're going to increase our support to the moderate opposition because we know more needs to be done.
He said, too, that there really is nothing we can point to that's been very successful in our policy except the removal of about 93% of some of Assad's chemical materials. But now he's using chlorine gas against his opponents. Can you tell us if there is any other success that you were been able to achieve in Syria?
I think we should not downplay the CW issue too much. I know it's tempting for people to do because it's gone up until this point, not perfectly, but we have removed so much of it. Because, look, if we had a choice between removing the chemical weapons and not removing them, obviously we're going to choose to remove them. And that's the choice we had.
Can I follow up on that? Mm-hmm. I mean, does it not disturb you that a longtime senior, serious former U.S. official who was directly, who was the point person for this policy, should state publicly that he no longer felt he was able to defend the U.S. policy? That doesn't bother you at all?
As I said, he's a private citizen. He's entitled to his views. What we're focused on today is the officials who are still here, who are working on Syria, who share the kind of frustration you've heard from the president, the secretary, and others.
Marie Harf, the State Department spokeswoman on the critique of the Obama administration's Syria policy, now voiced by the president's former ambassador in Damascus. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And that's the Friday edition of FSN Reports. Coming up on Monday, the economic challenges facing the acting profession. That's Monday, but for now I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone, with feature story news everywhere, have a great weekend. Goodbye.